You're listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Wonders of the World, Trials of the Soul, and Revelations of the Spirit. This is Lecture 8. In the last lecture, we have seen how, within the nature of man, there is an interplay of the varied forces of the macrocosm, and how the Greek soul perceived these forces of the macrocosm, and in its own way gave expression to them in what is to be found today in Greek mythology. The frequent reference I make to Greek mythology is not in order to explain it, but rather to throw the necessary light on primal truths from one special side, as in this way one gets a better idea of these than from the historical standpoint, than is possible through the abstract ideas of our life, which in their poverty are incapable of giving expression to great cosmic wonders. I have also shown how, in the figure of Dionysus, we meet with something that is connected with our most inward soul forces, with what I have called trials of the soul. What, in the true esoteric sense, are these trials of the soul? They occur when a man attempts to enter upon those paths of the soul which lead into the spiritual world. I gave some indication of the lightest and easiest of these trials in the last lecture. Speaking generally, we can say that they consist in this, that along the path into the higher worlds, one has experiences to which one only arrives by means of a certain preparation. The tests consist in the necessity of exerting oneself to endure the recognition of certain facts, and to confront this knowledge with calmness. Toward the end of the second Rosicrucian drama, The Soul's Probation, you were shown a fairly obvious psychic experience, and perhaps by means of this soul experience, we can demonstrate exactly what a trial or ordeal of the soul is. Let us think of the figure there, described as Capasius. From both the dramas we know what experiences Capasius goes through. We see how he gradually approaches spiritual life, how he first receives only premonitions of this through his healthy intelligence, which drives him from the scientific work which he had so far pursued. He has a premonition that the spiritual, intellectual world contains within it a still higher reality. And through the fact that he experiences these premonitions, and that they become quite living within him, he arrives at certain impressions which it is necessary for a man to have regarding what one might call the more external teachings of occultism, or spiritual science. The imparting of occult science is quite different, in principle, from, let us say, scientific or literary communications. The latter work probably only upon our intellect, and perhaps directly through our intellect upon our emotional forces, whereas that man only has allowed something of spiritual science to work upon him aright, who feels the inmost life of his soul thoroughly shaken, and in a certain way entirely changed, through that which flows not as abstract content but as life from all spiritual science. It is something of this sort that Capasius feels when, owing to his premonitions, he has wrestled through into himself. He then sinks in profound meditation in the first book of the soul's probation into the words of the so-called Book of Life, which originated from Benedictus. The result of this is not only that he reflects on it, that he racks his brain and wants to get at the back of the meaning of it, but he feels the spiritual world break in on him in what is for him an incomprehensible manner. There is yet another result. One might very easily compare the feeling which pervades the first scene of the drama with the beginning of Goethe's Faust, yet it is essentially different. The feeling pervading Faust really only indicates that one can arrive at a kind of skepticism, a doubt as regards all knowledge, and then from one's own inner human impulses is enabled to seek out other paths than those of ordinary knowledge or cognition. In the case of Capasius, there is still something else. At the very beginning, he is torn in two and thrown into a state of profound uncertainty through learning to look upon doubt and ignorance as man's greatest sin. He learns to recognize that in the depths of the human soul, something dwells which is not at first recognized by man's ordinary consciousness, something of which he knows nothing. A treasure lies deep down in the substrata of our souls. We conceal something within us, in the lowest strata of our soul, that is at first unrecognizable by normal consciousness. And when, according to the sense and true significance of spiritual science, we meditate deeply upon this fact, we learn that it is no mere selfish longing, but is one of the most serious duties of man, with regard to the forces of the macrocosm, not to allow the treasure which lies in our soul to perish. One learns that in every person living in the world there lies something in the depths of the soul, which at one time the gods took from their own body, from their own substance, and implanted within us. One learns to feel that the gods have foregone a part of their own nature, that they have, as it were, torn something out of their own flesh and have implanted it in our souls. Now, as men, we might do a twofold thing with this psychic treasure, which is a divine heritage. Owing to a certain human love of ease, we might say, "Oh, what do I want with knowledge? The gods will themselves bring me to the goal they desire." That they will not do, for they have implanted such a treasure deep within us, so that by our own free will we may bring it to the surface. We may therefore allow this inward treasure to fall into decay. That is one way the human soul may take. The second way is that we become conscious of our high duty toward the heavenly powers and say, we must raise this treasure up, must bring it forth out of the hidden depths into our consciousness. What do we do then? We give to this treasure another form than that which it had previously in the body of the gods. But in the form which it has assumed through us, we give it back again to the gods in a mysterious manner. We pursue no personal matter with our powers of understanding. We do nothing with our understanding that merely serves our own egoism. We do no less than bring back again to the higher worlds the gift, the noble inheritance the gods gave to us, in the altered form it has acquired through us, so that with us they may possess it once more. But if we let this treasure fall into decay, we do verily give rein to our egoism, for henceforward this treasure would remain irreparably lost to the world. We allow the divine heritage of the gods to fall into decay when we do not seek within us understanding. It is this that gives rise to the mood of Capasius. In the first scene of the second drama, he feels that it is his duty not to remain in doubt, not in any way to continue to feel that he could know nothing, but that it would be a very serious breach of duty toward the cosmic powers if he were to leave this treasure of his soul to wither. Only at first he feels himself incapable of using the instruments of his body for this purpose. That is the discrepancy in the soul of Capasius. It is no longer Faust-like. Much rather would he say to himself, quote, "You must realize that you absolutely dare not remain in ignorance, or yield at all to the feeling of how weak the forces are which we have at our disposal as the result of our ordinary life, and whereby I bring the hidden treasure to your soul, of your soul, to light." There is then only one thing to do, to trust in one's own soul. If with patience it gradually develops that which is deposited within us, then the forces which it as yet feels to be weak, must grow more and more, so that it can really fulfill its duty with regard to the cosmic powers. This trust in the fertility and productivity of the human soul must support us when, having only the force that we have acquired in the past, we often stand perplexed and afraid, realizing what we must and yet at the same moment we cannot do. All these trials of the soul are fundamentally of such a nature that we shrink from this fear, this feeling of impotence. Only when we find within ourselves that strength of soul which proceeds from the trust in oneself, the trust which gradually comes through a profound study of spiritual science, only then are we able to endure such trials. From the whole spirit of these lectures, you will already have seen that within the whole nature and being of man, there is an interplay of two cosmic torrents, and in order to harmonize these in man, strength of soul and also courage and determination are necessary. You find this clearly expressed at the close of the second drama, The Soul's Probation. There, we see how Capasius has gone through important occult experiences, how he ventures a glance into his previous incarnation, and dares to become acquainted with himself as he had been hundreds of years previously upon the earth. You then find a saying which must not be taken lightly, that the knowledge of one life imposes upon us duties for many lives, not merely for one. Imagine that in looking back into the preceding incarnation, one beholds one's debt to this or that person, and thereby feels weighed down with one's life's account. Something might come before our soul that would quite discourage us. We might realize, quote, in your present incarnation, you cannot make good everything that you have laid up against yourself in your debit account, close quote. There arises, in the case of many people at least, the deepest longing to make good as much as possible. But this feeling springs from egoism. For the egoism of most men, it is quite unbearable to think that they should have to take with them so much of this debit account through the portal of death. To know that they must die and take with them into their next incarnation this or that from their debit account. The courage to own to oneself freely and honorably, quote, you have evil deeds upon your soul, close quote, demands a high degree of selflessness, whereas in general a man's disposition is such that he wants to be as good as his ideal. Anyone who really has gone through occult experiences of this kind must be able to face his own evil deeds unreservedly. And in fact, he ought to be able to say to himself that it is impossible to make good everything in this life. Romanus, in the above drama, expresses this by saying that it is necessary we should carry debts from the preceding life through the portal of death, and look dauntlessly to the moment when the watcher who presents us with our debit account shall confront us. Then we are faced with another line of thought, which we may designate thus, quote, when a man practices true self-knowledge, when he really learns something of his own innermost being, he generally finds something that decidedly ought not to be there, something that is not only uncomfortable in the highest degree, but which, when it really appears, is crushing in its effect on him. Close quote. Compare with this fundamental feeling of the human soul, which has something crushing in it, that which holds sway in so many souls, even when they have made some acquaintance with spiritual science. How often one hears it said, quote, oh, I do that out of pure unselfishness. I desire nothing for myself, close quote. Perhaps it is precisely when one most wants something that one hides it from oneself by saying, quote, I don't want anything for myself, close quote. That is an everyday experience. It is better that one should own to the truth that one really wants for oneself those actions which are apparently the most selfless. By this means a foundation is laid by which one will learn by degrees to endure the picture which the guardian of the threshold, the watcher for the spiritual world, really sets before us. Let us now ask in a higher sense, Why do we find so much that is inharmonious within us? What is the reason for this? Well, you see, this is connected with the whole evolution of mankind. If we wish to understand why, when a man plunges more deeply into his own nature and being, he finds so much that is inharmonious, we must enter upon a more thorough consideration of the evolution of the human race. Let us then, for the moment, take it for granted that a deep soul treasure is hidden within us, which, for the normal consciousness of today, is entirely unknown. That when we find it out through the trials of our soul, we find endless disharmonies at the foundation of our soul, many things from which we recoil in horror, things that seem to crush us. What is it that we seem to bear within us? We all know that the evolution of mankind was a very complicated affair before man arrived at his present stage. We know that in order to attain to his present form, man had to go through the Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolutions, and that he only then entered upon his earthly evolution. When it is once recognized by a wider circle how really complicated the true facts of life are, how nothing can be understood of what man is and of what surrounds him without looking back to this Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolution, it will be seen how infinitely naive and superficial is that which modern abstract science has to offer. Through the Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolution, there was gradually prepared and formulated what we have today as the four principled nature of man. When the Moon evolution had run its course, man had attained to a certain stage of his evolution. The time between the Moon and the Earth evolution was then occupied in working up the spiritual part of man's nature, which had existed on the Moon, into new seed for Earth evolution. How then did men arrive at the Earth as the result of the Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolution? We have already answered this question from the most varied sides. Today we shall add a fresh side. Real occult facts cannot be grasped by merely driving in a few abstract ideas, but by allowing one's mind to be illuminated from all sides, and so drawing near to the truth. The paths to the higher truths are confused, and can only be travelled by those willing to wander patiently through labyrinths. How did man, having brought over the results of his Moon evolution, enter into his Earth evolution? That which is a man's physical body today did not exist at all in its present form when the Earth was at the beginning of its evolution. Even though the germinal beginnings of the physical body were present on ancient Saturn, even though on the Sun and on the Moon these germs had still further developed and had already attained on the old Moon to a high stage of advancement, you must realize that in the intermediate periods between the Sun and the Saturn evolution and between the Sun and the Moon evolution, all that had developed as foundation for the physical and other bodies once more returned to a spiritual condition. It passed over once more into supersensible substance when the Moon evolution came to an end. The physical part that had developed on Saturn and had taken on further form was naturally not then a physical thing. Everything was received back again into spirit. Everything was dissolved and existed in the spirit as forces, capable of calling forth physical forms, only the physical itself was not present. When the Earth evolution began, that which we call the physical body was not in existence as a physical body, but it existed spiritually in such a way that it could gradually condense itself into the physical body. It contained the forces which lead to the condensation or solidification of the physical body. We must take all this into consideration. Indeed, we can go still further. We know that we are now in the post-Atlantean age, and that this was preceded by the Atlantean and the Lemurian ages. And then when we go back beyond the Lemurian age, we arrive at yet earlier periods of earthly evolution. But when the Lemurian age approached, man had already not a physical body in its present form. No, excuse me. Man had certainly not a physical body in its present form. What is physical today existed then in its densest parts as etheric body. The forces of the present physical body were at that time as though dissolved in the etheric body. This etheric body had, however, such forces that when they condensed according to their own nature, they lead to what is now our physical body. In a certain way, they were the forces of the physical body, only they were not present as physical body. So, when man entered upon his Lemurian development, his densest bodily form was etheric, and all condensation to a physical body took place only from the Lemurian period onward. This condensation to a physical body was accomplished in a complicated manner. To spiritual vision, man existed at first in an etheric body. Within this etheric body were contained those forces of the physical body which had been acquired through the Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolution. These forces had the tendency to condense, so that the physical body arose by degrees, but it was not yet a physical body. Man would not, however, have become what he is today if the forces of his physical body had simply condensed in accordance with their predisposition at the time. If all that was germinal at the beginning of the Lemurian age had come to expression in the physical body of man, he would have appeared quite differently today, even in his external aspect. We must picture clearly to ourselves that man has a different appearance today from what he was predisposed to assume in that age which we place before the Lemurian period. In the course of the Lemurian, the Atlantean, and the post-Atlantean periods, not only have those forces been active in human nature, which were then present as predispositions, but other forces have also been at work. If we wish to form a clear idea as to how the forces of the etheric body worked still further, we can best do so by considering a certain organic system of the human physical body. We shall consider how one part of the human entity has developed from the etheric body since the Lemurian age. Let us suppose that this drawing represents the etheric body of man as it was before the Lemurian epoch, when earthly evolution began. Within this etheric body there are the most varied currents, the most varied lines of force, which are the result of the Saturn, Sun, and Moon developments. From among the currents of force within the etheric body, we select a certain number, which had as their aim and tended to bring about all that within the human organism we might call the circulation of the blood, with its central point in the heart. Thus, there were forces which, under the conditions on ancient Saturn, Sun, and Moon, were anchored in the etheric body before the age of Lemuria, and which consolidated in such a way that from them could spring as physical result the blood system, with its central point, the heart. We have thus turned our attention to that organic system which, from the Lemurian age onward, proceeded as a physical condensation of a certain type of forces belonging to our etheric body. As you can see, that, given the necessary treatment, ordinary salt will crystallize out of a solution of salt and water, so in a higher sense it is with what we call the blood system and the heart. This crystallizes out of those forces of the human etheric body which have the tendency to condense into the physical organic system. It was only in the course of the evolution of this earth that it was first possible for them to develop into the physical heart. We shall see later why this first took place in the course of the evolution of the earth, and had not already done so in the course of the moon evolution. What really does the blood system and the heart mean for us? They are condensations of the etheric world, of the forces of the etheric world. As regards earthly evolution, a kind of death would have come to pass at the moment these forces acquired the density of our physical heart and physical blood. In other words, those forces which are condensed within our heart and blood system. The most significant and mysterious part of earthly evolution is that not only did this condensation take place, not only did the forces which have been brought over from the old Saturn, the old Sun, and the old Moon solidify into such an organic system, not only did what was in the etheric body become physical body, but that for each of our organic systems within earthly evolution, an impulse entered through which had formerly been etheric and had condensed to physical was again dissolved and was again transformed into ether. Thus it is among the most important impulses of our earthly evolution that etheric forces, after having condensed to an organic system, are not left in that state, but that other forces or impulses come into play which dissolve them again in their turn. At that same moment in earthly evolution, in which our human organs attain their greatest density, certain powers of the macrocosm again dissolved the substance of these organic systems, so that what in earlier days had filtered, as it were, into these organic systems emerges once more. It is in the heart and the blood coursing through it that we can observe occultly with the greatest exactitude how this dissolving process takes place, and how the earth impulses intervene in the substances of such an organic system. To clairvoyant vision, something continually streams forth from our heart as the result of the circulation of the blood. When clairvoyantly you see the blood pulsating through the human body, you also see how this blood becomes thin in the heart, dissolving into its finest physical parts and returning to its etheric form. As the blood gradually took form in the ether, so in the present human body we have the processes reversed. The blood returns to its etheric form. Etheric streams are continually passing upward from the heart to the human head, so that we see the etheric body being reformed all along the course of the blood. Thus that which crystallized in the pre-Lemurian times out of the ether into the human blood system and the heart, we now see etherized in man and streaming upward in the human etheric body to the head. And if this portion of the human etheric streams did not continually rise up from the heart to the head, we might try as we liked, but we would not be able to think or know anything about the world through the mere instrumentality of our brain. We would not be able to think at all. Our brain would be a thoroughly unpractical instrument for understanding if it were to work in physical brain as physical brain alone. By means of occultism, one can get an idea of how the brain would work if it had to depend on itself. In that case, a man would be able to think only of what related to the inner requirements of his body. He would think, for example, quote, "Now I am hungry, now I am thirsty, now I will satisfy this or that desire," close quote. He would be able to think only of that which related to his bodily needs. And if he were dependent only on his physical brain, he would be the greatest egoist imaginable. Our brain, however, is continually infiltrated by the fine etheric streams which flow upward from the heart. These etheric currents have direct relationship with a delicate and important organ of the brain, the so-called pineal gland. The fine etheric currents which I have described to you continually interpenetrate and lave the pineal gland, making it glow. And its movements, as an organ of the physical brain, are in harmony with the currents which, as I have said, proceed from the heart. Because of this, these etheric movements are again connected with the physical brain. They stamp upon the physical brain, in addition to egoistic knowledge mentioned before, that which makes it possible for us to recognize something of the outer world, something of that which we ourselves are not. By way of our pineal gland, our etherized blood system reacts directly upon our brain. You will find this subject more fully dealt with when those lectures appear which I gave in Prague, quote, occult physiology, close quote. There, from another point of view, I enlarged on this very matter of the function of the pineal gland. Thus we see that within the earth evolution, we have not only a process which leads to densification, but also one that again etherealizes. If we keep this in mind, we must say that we bear within us forces which to a certain extent are restored to the form which was already theirs during the old Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolution. Man, as he is constituted at the present day, knows nothing through his ordinary consciousness of the wonderful play of forces within his etheric body, which set up communication between his heart and his brain. Anyone who, in the course of his occult training, becomes conscious of these etheric currents is aware of them in a peculiar way. And here self-knowledge offers something that is in the highest degree significant. Through it one learns to recognize how these forces stream out from the heart to the brain, in order to mold the brain so that man can use it as the instrument of his soul life. One notices, however, at once that these forces have not passed unscathed through the human organism, that they are not the same when man releases them as when they entered his heart. All that the man has meanwhile developed out of the unconscious part of his being in the way of lower impulses and desires, all that is passed into his own nature, is carried along with the etheric stream which he reforms from out his heart. In old Lemuria we received it in a certain way as a pure etheric stream which had no other desire nor will than to condense into the wonderful wisdom and filled structure of the heart. We then lived on as physical men with this heart and blood system. We passed through various incarnations without knowing anything of this condensation of our former etheric body to the physical heart and blood system. We have, however, become permeated with all that has passed through us as desires and longings, sympathies and antipathies, affections and passions, habits and errors. And by all these, the etheric body which has recently come into being and passed upward to the brain is permeated and dimmed. This we send upward from our hearts to our brain, and of this we now become aware in true self-knowledge. We become aware that we cannot render again to the gods in the same way what we have received from them into the depths of our bodily life, but we can only return it sullied by our own nature. We must now gradually approach that which has just been described as a kind of impurity of our own nature. If this is to be understood, we must keep in mind the following. When the Saturn evolution began, and indeed before it had begun, the etheric current of all humanity and of all earthly evolution was, as has been stated, as yet one single stream. And it was precisely at the moment the Saturn development began that the division, the duality, in the forces of the macrocosm arose. Why this arose we shall explain later. At present, we desire only to mention the fact. It was only at the moment when the Saturn development began that duality first entered into all macrocosmic activities. This duality is referred to in Greek mythology, where it makes ancient Saturn, or Kronos, as the ancient Greeks called him, the opponent of his father Uranus, thereby showing that this mythology was aware that originally unity obtained among all the macrocosmic forces. But when ancient Saturn or Kronos began to crystallize, something that was hidden within the nature of Saturn started opposition to the universal course of evolution. A duality made its appearance. And if we abide by previous statements, we might put it thus, quote, the sum of the divine spiritual beings who controlled evolution when Saturn began its existence, divided into two camps. Close quote. Thus we have one stream of evolution which participates directly in everything that happened throughout the Saturn-Sun-Moon periods down to our Earth, and another stream side by side with this. To use a homely comparison, you might picture this adjacent stream somewhat as you picture the atmosphere which surrounds the Earth as a finer substance compared to the denser parts of the Earth, the water and the solid Earth. So we might also picture to ourselves that a denser evolution occurs on Saturn, Sun, and Moon, but that this denser evolution is ever surrounded by a more ethereal one. We might picture to ourselves that the divine spiritual beings of ancient Saturn, Sun, and Moon worked directly upon their own substance, but that there were always other divine spiritual beings in the periphery who on their side surrounded the spiritual beings active in Saturn, Sun, and Moon as the air surrounds the Earth. We have indicated here the realms of two classes of gods or spirits, one of which participated directly in everything, entered into everything that happened successively on Saturn, Sun, and Moon. The other generation or class of gods kept themselves somewhat at a distance and only intervened from outside. And we must now try to form some idea of how the one kind of god stood related to the other kind. I must ask you to pay special attention to what the relation is of the more comprehensive gods who took direct part in the Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolutions to the other gods who floated, as it were, round this cosmic ball in its successive phases. You can best form an idea of this when you consider man. Take the human soul. It thinks. This means that it brings forth thoughts. That is a process which takes place in us and is caused by the fact that on one hand we are this real psychic being, and that on the other hand we are continually progressing, and our thoughts, as it were, continually veil this soul. As regards his thinking, man is still a psychic being, at a relatively lower stage of organization. Those beings whom we have just now designated as gods, and have divided into two categories, stand on a far higher level. Picture to yourselves that man was not only in a condition to grasp his thoughts merely as thoughts, but that the human soul was so strong that what it thought immediately became alive, that man could bring forth thoughts as living entities, that when he grasped a thought it immediately became a reality. It does remain in this way in the Akashic records, but it does not become so solid as to appear before one as a reality. Now imagine that we did not only think thoughts, but with every thought we brought forth an entity. You would then have grasped what took place in the divine spiritual world. While living in the most beautiful harmony, in the most perfect unity, the gods who existed prior to ancient Saturn reproduced themselves. They thought. Their thoughts, however, were not like human thoughts, which may be considered unreal, but they were living entities. They were other gods. Thus we have classes of gods who were originally real of themselves, and others who were actually the ideas of those gods, and were directly connected with Saturn, Sun, and Moon. These are the divine beings who hover, as it were, over the cosmic globe of Saturn, Sun, and Moon as it passes through its successive evolutions. Thus we have two different generations of gods. The one generation of gods is the conceptual world of the other, and actually stands related to the other as our thoughts are related to our actual soul existence. What name have we hitherto applied to those gods who are actually the thoughts of the others? Those gods which are simply the thoughts of the others we have called, on account of certain qualities, the Luciferic beings. And in the evident sense, we must reckon, as belonging to the Luciferic beings, everything of which we can say, the original gods felt the necessity of presenting themselves to themselves for recognition. Consequently, they presented the luciferic beings to themselves as cosmic thoughts, or thought entities, just as a man is today confronted by his thoughts. As man really first learns to know himself in his thoughts, so did the original gods learn to know themselves in Lucifer and his hosts. We might express this somewhat differently. We might say that these beings, who were really only the conceptions of the others, have always remained behind with regard to the others' evolution. The progressive gods had left something of themselves behind, so that they could look back upon it. As in actual life one can only recognize oneself in a mirror, so they could see themselves in this mirror, thrown off from their own substance. The luciferic beings are beings that had remained behind, entities thrown off from the original gods, and who came to being in order that a mirror of self-cognition might exist for the advancing godlike entities. In a certain sense, what takes place microcosmically within our own soul is a complete image or reflection of this macrocosmic event. Only in us is reversed that which in a way was accomplished aforetime in the macrocosm. We bear within our microcosm a reflection of this division among the gods, of these two classes of gods, of which the one was original, and the other class was born from the original beings, and existed so that these other beings might have something with which to confront themselves. From this you can infer that there must be a great difference between the two lines of descent of these gods. And this difference indeed is clearly revealed. It is revealed in the fact that our whole self, with all that is unconscious in us, this whole far-reaching self from which our bodily organism has also proceeded, sprung from the original generation of gods. Nevertheless, what we experience with our ordinary daily consciousness springs from the generation of the gods who are but the conception or thought of the first. Our nature comes to us from two sides. Our complete organization, with all that is contained in our subconsciousness, comes from the original generation of the gods. That of which we are conscious comes from the other class of gods. Hence we find, when we enter deeply into our life of thought and ideas, that this youngest daughter, so to say, of a line of gods, is in a highest sense but a reflection, a presentiment. And we are aware of the unreality, the elusive thought-like character of our conscious life, like will-o'-the-wisps. This was something that was also evident to the pupils of the Greek mysteries, for it was clearly revealed to them. In the whole course of advancing evolution, there are to be found streams of divine activity which are all-embracing, and which permeate us unconsciously with their whole essence. There are others, however, which are only able to receive the ordinary normal consciousness. It becomes clear to the Greek pupils of the mysteries that they must disregard normal consciousness and must turn to the ancient gods, who are also called the gods of the underworld, in whose nature Dionysus also had a share. Only by doing so could they acquire knowledge of the true nature of man. There is one being only within earthly evolution, through whom a quite new element of clairvoyance, and also a new element of soul and will power, permeated by occult forces, can enter into us. Up to a certain point of time, it was indeed only possible for that to enter man, which I have just described as proceeding from the line of divinities who brooded over ancient Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolutions. This entered human consciousness from outside, without man having to descend into his inner being, into the realm of the lower nether gods. Only such knowledge could enter as could never have attained to actual world reality. By external means of knowledge, it was possible for man to attain to actual reality. To gain this, something would have to mingle with that which entered man's ordinary consciousness from without. During the long periods of the Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolutions, something that was not merely the thought life of the lower gods, but which was reality. This something which had to enter caused that which confronted us as our life of thought, the unreal, non-actual, to be suddenly driven out. And for a moment it was filled so full of substantial reality that a specially outstanding thought was able to endure, to remain near us, like our own soul, as reality. Something had to intervene if the divine beings hovering in the periphery were to continue to work as hitherto. They had worked for all ages through the wider self, right down into our bodily organism. Something had to pour into us from without, which signified a renewal, a resurrection from the spiritual world, a recrudescence of that which had organized us, and which had then withdrawn into the depth of our consciousness. That which entered in a moment into this generation of divine beings was, in fact, the Christ, who at the baptism in Jordan entered into the body of Jesus of Nazareth. With Christ, a divine being entered physical life by the same path as was chosen by those gods who at an earlier time were really only beings evoked by the thoughts of other gods. Now for the first time, a real being appears, one who is not in the same sense merely a conception of other gods, but who is a substantial, independent being. From celestial space, where previously only the ideas of the other gods had lived, there comes a divine thought which is actuality. How could this come to pass? Through the fact that the significant event of the baptism by John in Jordan had long been in preparation throughout the whole course of human evolution, through the Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolutions. That which happened by the Jordan, and later through the mystery of Golgotha, is the echo of another most important event, which had taken place in a very distant past, which we must relegate to the old solar evolution. In the evolution which has so far taken place, we have the Saturn, Sun, Moon, and Earth evolutions. In the Earth evolution was experienced the mystery of Golgotha and the baptism by John in Jordan. During the old Sun evolution, we are able to discover by means of the Akashic records another most significant event, which may be described in the following way. At that time, a certain process had reached its farthest point of advancement, regarding which one may say that the upper gods, who form the conceptions of the lower gods, and are thus dependent upon them, if I may permit myself to make use of a trivial expression, found it more suitable to their peculiar nature to live in ethereal elements of the upper worlds, rather than in the denser elements from which the earth was formed. It was during the Sun evolution that the separation already referred to took place between the two different genera or classes of gods, one that of the real ancient gods arranging to continue to dwell with the elements, with earth, water, and air. The other genera of gods found it too arduous to enter into these dense elements, and continued to live in what we call the etheric elements, first in the heat, then in the light, and then in the chemical or life ether. We might also describe these two continuous streams of divine evolution by saying that the one chose the more difficult way, going through the denser elements. The other chose the easier way. That is, these gods hovered, as it were, around the others in the chemical and life ether, and formed their bodies from them. Everything which lives in these finer etheric elements formed their bodies in the same way. Everything that developed forces enabling them to live at all permanently in these more rarefied elements and this took place principally during the old sun evolution. About the middle of the solar evolution, however, a stupendous event took place, namely, that during this period of being developed forces which were in opposition to these finer, more rarefied etheric elements. In contradistinction to the mystery of Golgotha, the great earth sacrifice, we can speak of a solar sacrifice, which consisted in this, that a being did certainly choose his dwelling place among those gods who desired to live only in the finer elements. But he developed forces of a so much denser quality as were suited to the elements of the earth. Thus, ever since the sun evolution, we have had a being in the ranks of those who were really only armed with forces suited to the etheric world, who from within etheric realms had an inner relationship to what appertained to the earth. From the time of the ancient sun evolution, this being had awaited the right moment to introduce into the earth those forces which he had evolved. The greatest service rendered by Zoroaster was that he realized this and declared, "Within that which shines in the heavens above as the sun, something has remained behind from the ancient sun, and in it meantime dwells this being." But the time drew near when this being was to bring down to earth a form which was suited to the elements of the earth. The moment came wherein mankind, though itself really not yet mature enough to recognize this being, who is compounded of the substance of the etheric world, could still at least recognize his reflection. It was a preparation, and for reasons which we shall hear later, this being revealed himself in the course of evolution, not at first as himself, but as a reflection. This can be made more comprehensible by saying, this reflection bore the same relation to reality as the moonlight to the direct sunlight it reflects. That being who had prepared himself for his great act of Golgotha during the old sun period was first shown to men in his reflected image, and this reflection was called by the old Hebrew people Yahweh or Jehovah. Jehovah is the reflection of Christ, being in essence the same as Christ, only seen aforetime, as it were, prophetically. He showed himself thus prophetically, until the time came when this mighty being could show himself not merely in his reflection, but in his own original form. Thus we see the event of greatest importance for the earth foreshadowed on the ancient sun. We see humanity prepared for Christ through ancient Hebraism. We see the being who once separated himself from the earth and took up his abode in the sun, descending to earth once more. But we also see how he is shown to man at first in a reflection, as an idea, as it were, or a presentment. As the upper gods stand related to the lower, so is Jehovah the presentment of the real Christ. And for those who can see profoundly into things, he resembles him exactly. Hence, in a certain way, we can speak of Jehovah Christ. And here we come in contact with the true meaning of the Gospels, where we are told that Christ himself said, quote, "If ye desire to learn to know me, then must ye also know what is said of me in Moses and the prophets." Close quote. Christ knew well that when in the olden times Jehovah was mentioned, it was himself who was spoken of, that all that was said of Jehovah was related to himself in the same way as a reflection is related to its original. The end of Lecture 8.